relatively recently, his company is very strategically located about a 10-minute drive from my mom's house in Raleigh, North Carolina. So I thank him for that. And I'm really excited about the interesting new work that they're doing, kind of approaching small fruit breeding from a really different perspective in a different way. So I'll let him take it away and tell us more about his company and what he does there.
So this will be a little bit different since Pairwise Plants is not currently breeding anything. Currently, we are a genome editing company, and so I thought I'd walk you through a little bit about the company first and give you some background, then I'd share my story a little bit about how I got to where I am today. So about a year and a half ago, the company started. It's about 15 months old officially. We started with five people. We're now at 92, I think is our official number. So it's been a really quick growth over the last 15 months. And our attention is focused really in two separate areas. One place is in the row crops, and that's because we have a $100 million contract with Bayer Crop Science to produce edited corn, soybean, cotton, wheat, and canola. So we actually go through the process of figuring out the traits that we want to modify. We find the genetic targets. We construct the editing reagents that we're going to use to edit those genes to create new alleles. And then we actually make those plants in the lab, and then we do the first round of testing in our greenhouses before it goes back to them. So that's one half of it. The other half is sort of a joint venture between Deerfield Capital and now Bayer Crop Science for our seed money, which was $25 million. And that's really to focus on the consumer fruit and vegetable space. And so we started looking at different opportunities there where gene editing might be useful to bring in some new traits that bring value to the end consumer. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. So what our company really is based on right now is the ability to do gene editing. And so to get this started, we actually spent a lot of time licensing in all the patents to do this because it's an incredibly complicated patent landscape. So we not only have the ability to do what you hear people say, molecular scissors, and what they really mean are making double-stranded breaks in DNA and then letting the native mechanisms do the repair and create different and new alleles with insertions and deletions. We do that, as well as we have exclusive licensing from Harvard, Broad, and MGH to do base pair editing. And so that's actually going in, not making a cut, but actually just changing one base pair to another base pair so you can create the exact allele that you want to. The other place where we're a little different than the other gene editing companies is that we're really focused on consumer value. So we believe that when the first versions of biotechnology came around in the 80s, i.e. transgenics, all the value went to the farmer, and the consumer got a very indirect benefit from that. It was very hard for them to tangibly understand why their crops were, why their commodities were cheaper, why they had less aflatoxin in them, why they had less insecticide sprayed on them. What we're hoping to do with editing technology is actually work on traits where there's a lot of value for the end consumer and actually give the consumer traits that they couldn't have had without editing so that they come to have a positive association between the technology and then the product itself. I think I just talked over my next slide. The way we're targeting all that is to actually steer people away from the junk food aisle. So there's a huge barrier for people to select fresh produce simply because it's not convenient. It requires a lot of preparation work. It's not shelf stable, so it uses a waste if you leave it in your fridge too long. Whereas junk food can sit around for years. It's very, very easy on the go. It's all in a wrapper. You throw the wrapper away when you're done. Less than 20% of Americans actually get their recommended amount of fruit and vegetables every day. And we think that we can use editing technology to make some more convenience traits in the produce aisle for consumers. This is just a little thing about some of the people that got the company started. Two at the top, Tom and Haven, it's our chief executive officer and our chief business officer. They're the ones that had the idea and got the company going. Down the bottom, these are the three faculty members at Harvard, Broad, and MGH, and MIT that that put their patents into getting the company started. So they're scientific co-founders as well. We're not on the West Coast. We're on the East Coast. We're in Durham, North Carolina. That's why we're so close to Margaret's mother's house. We have two facilities. One, we have a 24,000 square foot greenhouse space and about eight and controlled environment space also with growth chambers and the Research Triangle Park. And we are just completing right now our main office, which is down on the Golden Belt campus in downtown Durham. That is a 36,000 square foot space that's got our laboratories, our transformation facilities, and all of our office space. So that was really quick. So a little bit about how I came here. I was always interested in plants. So I was growing, like picking seeds and growing fungus on bread under my bed when I was a kid, which my mother did not approve of. So I always had kind of this interest in this. And then I worked on a local family farm when I was 14. It was a vegetable farm, and literally they grew everything there. So that was my first real introduction of production agriculture. That led me to be interested enough that when I went off to college, I got a degree in plant science. And then at that point, I thought I really wanted to go into plant pathology, and I worked in a plant pathology lab for 4 years. And then my junior year, I took an evolution course, and I realized genetics was actually okay and it wasn't terrible. And so I wound up getting my PhD in quantitative and evolutionary genetics working at cotton at Iowa State. From there, if anyone remember what's happening in 2008? Yes, right? So all of the faculty positions and postdoc positions were evaporating at that time. I actually had an NSF postdoc, but it didn't look like that there would be any positions open after that. So I ended up taking a position I got offered at Monsanto, and I was their marker discovery lead for corn and soybean for a number of years. So that was an interesting time because we just had gotten next-generation sequencing, and so we brought online the first 80,000 SNP panel for maize and the first 50,000 SNP panel for soybean. From there, that led to a great effort around mapping a bunch of different traits and getting it deployed in the breeding pipeline. I left molecular breeding and I went to the biotech side, so actually working on the transgenics. I ran the drought biotech project for a number of years before, in the last couple of years, I went over to the business side. Once I was on the business side, an opportunity came up to work for Illumina, a company that makes a lot of these DNA sequencing machines, and for 2 years I was out in California as their head of their agrigenomics business. And then sort of the circle came all the way back around, and Tom called me because Pairwise Plants was getting started, and it was an opportunity that was too good just to not pass up, and so I moved back to North Carolina to help get the company started. I would point out, we do have lots of open positions, so if any of you are graduating or finishing your postdocs, please check out our website. And also keep in mind that with industry, there are 75% of you who are getting PhDs or masters are going to wind up in industry. Only 25% of higher degrees work in higher education and at the university. So there's nothing wrong with working at a company. I always thought I'd be in academia, and worked out that I'm in industry, and I've loved every minute of it. So thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, everyone. That was very informative, and you were so nice and concise that we had just the amount of time I was hoping for questions and answers. So I guess what I'll do is, because this is being recorded still, for anyone who wants to listen later, if you say a question, I'll repeat it again for you guys up here so that it gets recorded and you don't just hear the answer, and then we'll let the panel take it away. Whoever wants to jump in and is most enthusiastic can take it away. So I'll open it up to questions from the audience. Okay, go for it.
So I've asked this question to somebody at your school before, but when you buy blueberries at the store, they're just marketed as blueberries. But there's so many varieties that taste good and some that really are not very good. Is there any push at Driscoll's or at any other private or public places that to market blueberries as Draper or as Jersey or something like that rather than just blueberry?
Yeah, the question to repeat for those listening later is that you know, currently blueberries and all of the small fruit, really, except for maybe the grapes that David is working on, are marketed just kind of as a big commodity, a blueberry, instead of being marketed by the variety name, and there's a lot of differences in quality. So is there any interest among industry folks in changing that down the road?
So our marketing team has told us that there are lots of issues with marketing specific cultivars. It's done in places like if you go to the UK or Spain and Portugal, you will actually see the cultivar on that label for Driscoll's varieties. But currently we're moving into a special pick label, so you won't actually see the cultivar, but that'll be berries that we've validated have higher flavor components. So hopefully someday we'll be marketing by cultivar, but that isn't the current plan, at least.
So one of the issues around that is that we turn over cultivars really fast. I mean, the average lifespan of a Driscoll strawberry variety is about 3.5 years. And so you don't want people to get attached to varieties and slow down that turnover because, you know, it's, I mean, there's good and bad things. I mean, there are definitely advantages to having people get attached to your varieties, but it can also become a handicap, and I think we're very conscious of that.
Yeah, maybe before we move on to the next question, David, can you weigh in? Because your company is doing something really interesting in a different direction with cotton candy particularly.
Right. We're trying to create some brand identity. We don't do supermarket advertising or anything like that, but we do want to create a trademark that can live on, Pink Lady Apple, for instance. You can sell it as Crips Pink, but you still get a premium because of the trademark Pink Lady, even though it's any grower can grow the variety. So it is a double-edged sword, though, because you got to maintain quality standards. Your name's out there, and it's not a generic product, so when the consumer gets one bad clamshell or bag of grapes, then it hurts you as much as it helps us. So you really got to have some quality control. The other issue is there's so many varieties. I mean, we've just submitted the patent on our 45th variety of grapes. And it gets confusing because all the other breeding programs have a lot of varieties. So all of a sudden, the growers, the supermarket chains have, 100 varieties of grapes. What do I do? They throw up their hands. And in some ways, they just want generic red, black, and green grapes. And we're trying to go the other way where we want them to recognize our varieties over our competitors' varieties. So there's it's no simple answer.
That was a real good question. Okay, yes.
Mm-hmm. So to follow up on that, so a long time ago Starks Nursery basically trademarked the brand that they wanted, and then ran varieties through the brand so that you had they had Starks and Delicious or something, and they and they had different varieties.
But Starks Nursery. The comment was that another approach that has been taken was that Starks Nursery has marketed. They have a trademark for their whole brand instead of for the individual varieties. And I mean, I guess Driscoll's does that. Driscoll's has their name very prominent, and people associate that with quality. So that too. Okay. Any other questions? So many. Good. From the lady in the front.
I wanted to ask you at Driscoll's about the rosé or rose strawberry because I kind of see it as a new product, or at least consumers don't know pink strawberries that they could have existed. So what kind of effort does that take from a company to develop almost a new fruit product for the market?
So that's...
Oh, wait. Let me repeat the question. Okay. Sorry. The question was about the rosé strawberries, the very pale pink ones, and what kind of effort does Driscoll's have to do to introduce a very new product that consumers are unfamiliar with?
So the answer is a tremendous amount of effort, and the majority of that is not breeding effort. I've been at Driscoll's 12 years, and I inherited the white and pink strawberry material. And I think a lot of people have kind of wondered what the heck we were doing with it. And if I'm being honest, I kind of kept it around mostly because it was cool. there were some other traits that were interesting in it, too, that I used to justify that. But it's taken a long time. We're 10 generations into that material. And it's taken a long, long time to get it back to something that was, even close horticulturally. It's had the flavor for a long time. I think the flavor is excellent. But the trick has been, you know, Driscoll's is kind of a big machine that's really set up to, you know, we turn over varieties fast. We kind of, you know, we're very good at selling the four products that we have, but we're not really super comfortable with, you know, anything different. And so if I have a new red strawberry variety, we have a whole sort of procedure of how we ramp things up. It goes into our label. The growers grow it. We take observations and figure out where it's going. You can't really just slot a pink strawberry into the regular label and just figure it'll get figured out. So this one has been kicking around. I mean, it was ready to go out 4 years ago, and nobody really knew what to do with it. And I give our marketing people a lot of credit for kind of figuring out a way to handle it, and they're doing an excellent job. I give myself some credit because I forced them to do it by just beating them over the head with it for several years. But it's been really gratifying. It's still a challenging product. The shelf life is not good, and so we're sort of grappling with how do you manage a product that you can't treat like our other berries. But it's been pretty cool. So, thanks.
Okay, in the far back. Ryan.
Sorry.
Oh, I can see it now. So I'm just wondering if you could comment on the relative emphasis of genome editing in structural genes as opposed to regulatory genes.
Okay, technical question. Our question was for Ryan from Pairwise to talk about the importance of structural genes. Was it structural genes versus regulatory? Or?
Genome editing.
Structural genes versus regulatory genes. Gene editing.
So just as a way of clarification, by structural genes, you mean genes that are contributing to morphology or contributing to...
Any gene that actually results in a protein that is synthesized as opposed to genes involved in regulation, whether they be promoters or actually regulatory sequences that contribute to the modulation and expression.
So this is not innovation. This is my actual answer. They're both wildly important. There's plenty of cases where single base pair mutations result in some of the most dramatic phenotypes we know, especially around things like flowering time, around architecture. A lot of the classical architectural mutants in plants are all single base pair mutations. They give you an amino acid change inside the gene. At the same time, there's fantastic examples about how regulatory changes have also changed plant morphology and architecture. Examples are like TB1 and maize. So that's a regulatory element that's about 66 kb away from the start of the gene that changes its expression. So they're both, and we focus on both. The way we think about how we do the gene editing is different in the two groups. So in the structural type genes or within the coding sequence itself, it's usually much more defined because you know exactly the motif you're dealing with. There's protein structures for a lot of those genes now, and so you really have hypothesis-driven stuff. As much as it pains me to admit it because I worked on gene expression for my PhD, we still don't know a lot about gene expression. We're learning, and so a lot of the work that we do in the promoter regions and with cis and trans elements that regulate expression is very more like targeted mutagenesis than anything else. Yeah.
Great. Okay. I believe we had a question.
Mm-hmm. Right. So for Driscoll's with the strawberries, what proportion of your sales are organic versus conventionally grown? First question. And are you growing different cultivars for the organic market than you are for the conventional market?
The question was, how important is the organic versus conventional for Driscoll sales, and are the same cultivars used for both markets?
So overall, it's roughly 20%, maybe a little bit higher. That varies a lot from location to location, so it's considerably higher than that in the Watsonville area where I'm based, but there's also no organic in Florida, for example. As far as the varieties, what it tends to be in most cases is we sort of have our regular conventional variety lineup, but then we cross out a few things that just don't work. So In general, we don't have specialized organic varieties per se, but in some cases it's sort of evolved that way. So like in Watsonville right now, we have a variety Big Sur that is our main organic variety. It was once a prominent conventional variety, but it's sort of been surpassed in conventional by other things, but hasn't really been beaten in organic yet. So there are some differences there.
Mm-hmm. David?
Referring to Dr. Clark's comment at the beginning of this session, saying that when he started at his career, fruit breeding was predominantly public and academic, and it shifted increasingly to private concerns. My question for the panel is, what balance of public and private, public and private breeding best serves the interests of consumers? And choosing where we're going is sort of like a moving target. Is where we're headed towards, will that best serve the interests of consumers? I know that's sort of a too sophisticated and interlocking question. I hope
that I can summarize this very sophisticated and interlocking question. I think the question was, reaching back to what Dr. Clark's comments at the beginning, that fruit breeding used to be very heavily concentrated in the public sector, now it's moving more private. Is that the most advantageous scenario for consumers? What's the right balance? And, you know, with the increasing privatization, is that the best way for us to move forward for consumers? More or less, right? Who feels most passionately?
You're the oldest. You go first.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, I think that the industry is it's going to grow more in the private sector. I think you see consolidation within the farming community. The big farms are getting bigger. There's in California grapes and other crops. You see big pension funds buying huge acreages of land and that sort of thing. And the ability of huge companies to put research dollars into agricultural research, I think they kind of outcompete the university sector. And you know, the reality of our society is that now only 2% of agriculture, you know, people work on in agriculture, not like it was pre-World War II when we were basically an agrarian society and there was a huge support for the university and plant science research. So I think it's going to keep changing. I'm wondering who's going to train all the future plant breeders if it's all in the private sector. I think that's an important concern.
Speaking as a private individual and not representing Driscoll's, I'm a huge supporter of public fruit breeding, and I think it's really important. That said, I think the trends are towards less of that and more of the private side of things, and I think if people see value in it, it's going to take conscious effort from universities and governments to make that happen. And I think it's really important as an industry, you know, looking beyond Driscoll's. I think you should all just eat Driscoll's fruit and not worry about it. But you know, for an industry to remain dynamic and competitive, you have to have people out there to compete with, and I think a healthy public breeding program lowers that barrier of entry enough to let other people play in the game. And I worry a little bit when you see a couple big companies really sort of lock up the ability to get competitive varieties. But at the same time, I think we need different things from the public programs. You know, I think I would like to see cultivar development happening, but there's work that we will probably never invest in, less directly applied perhaps, or germplasm development, things that are better suited to the public sector. And I would hope that the breeding programs would continue to do that kind of work as well. at the very least so they can train the breeders of tomorrow.
So there, I think, is huge value in the huge value in the public sector. So Driscoll's picked up blueberries in the late 90s, and at that time they didn't decide to just start from scratch and go back to the wild germplasm. We pulled germplasm from all the public programs, so it was a huge resource for us to be able to develop a breeding program starting at commercial level quality. That being said, to the part of your question about what most benefits the consumer, I think as a company we have a little more power to tell growers what to grow and maybe encourage them with giving them premiums for fruit that's better, although it may not yield as much. So in that way, the consumer does gain from having that private label and having us have the growers grow less yielding fruit in favor of flavor.
You have anything to add?
Yeah. So coming from one of the largest sort of row, I can maybe get a little row crop perspective on this as well, since that ship has sort of sailed around corn and soybean, right? And coming from Iowa State, which historically has some of the largest corn breeding programs in the country, they can still work together, and it really comes down to what the state's mandate is, right? So what the state's mandate is for what's grown in that region, and it has to find a way to work with industry in the state, and so there has to be a willingness to have that collaboration. I think the idea that was brought up about, you know, focusing on the fundamental genetics, bringing in new traits, creating things that can be licensed out to the companies is a great example of where that's worked in the past. And then to the second part of your question, is it good for the consumer? It's good for the consumer if we focus on the consumer. And that's one of the reasons why we're focusing more on being a mission-driven company around finding ways to create healthier options for people that make them select those healthier options in the food aisle. So it's really, I think it can be, it's just you have to focus on it if you want it to be.
Before I go on to other questions from the audience, because I have something kind of related, I'm going to jump in. One thing that I think is kind of different between row crops and the way that fruit breeding privatization is going is, you know, the licensing of varieties rather than selling the variety. And so, you know, people have to be a member of a club or big enough to be chosen as a Driscoll's grower. So it seems like it may affect growers, the privatization, more than maybe consumers. And do you guys have any feeling on that? Or Ryan, you know, what do you think your approach will be when you have your first new caneberry variety out?
So you're asking about
the like club or licensing versus having something kind of available to whoever is willing to pay the royalties.
Yeah. So do we have anyone here from the retail sector, from the stores? No? Okay. So I think a lot of it is about taking a little power back from the retailers. So having the ability to focus on varieties and what the consumer wants and making the channel adapt to that. So you have to have something that people really, really want. And if you can do that and you can accomplish that, you can have products that are in a club format. You can have them widely sold. There's a lot of options that become possible when you get to that point. That's how we're thinking about it, at least.
Any other comments on that? Or?
I would just say, you know, from the consumer's point of view, I think in some ways by having an open market, there's sort of a push to the lowest common denominator. You know, you wind up more yield driven, more shelf life driven, the sort of basics to just make the volume game work. And I think when you have a more restricted sort of thing, whether it's a club or you know, Driscoll's model or something like that, it's like you're saying, it's taking the power back from the retailers a little bit and being able to prioritize some things that you might not otherwise be able to prioritize. I mean, that's kind of Driscoll's model is, you know, we tell growers what to grow and sometimes how to grow it. And in exchange, we make it possible for them to make that bargain of, you know, lower yield for higher flavor. And we deliver back to them a premium based on that.
Those are really interesting answers. Courtney?
Well, I wanted to follow up a little on the public-private and where the next generation of breeders are going to come from. So in the past, when there were a lot of public programs, it was because they were funded by the public through tax, through the state and federal government. that has gone away as it's become more privatized, and the benefit has gone to the private corporations because that's where they're getting their breeders from. So do you think there's a role or responsibility for these public or private companies to fund those private programs through breeding or through graduate students or other ways, and to be direct advocates at the state and local government level to keep those programs funded?
The question is, would you guys like to fund some graduate assistantships for me and Courtney Weber and other public breeders around here?
Talk to our accountants. I mentioned our relationship with the university. I think that's a good example of how we can go forward, and I think it's very synergistic, I think it's benefited our company. I know for sure. I think that the university has had some good financial rewards that we've given to them in exchange for that use of their germplasm. And I think those are kind of cooperative things that can go on. It's difficult. I used to say when the USDA was working when Dave Ramming was there and worked on grapes, it's hard to compete with free, you know. So I think now all of the universities, as far as I know, also are, you know, looking at royalty structures, you know, whether it's Cornell apples or Washington State apples or Minnesota. So I think the funding situation's changed. I don't think it'll go back to being a state or USDA funded or, you know, national funding. We've got to look at how to work together in some new formats. Yeah.
Any other comments on that, or how graduate student funding and support public-private collaboration?
Yeah, I mean, so if the breeding companies continue to grow and the demand for those jobs are there, the universities have shown that they have found a way to fill it. Now, I don't think that means that it's two separate entities, right? It's a partnership between the two, and that's why we're doing things right now. Even though we're a small company, we already have internships for undergrads and postdocs. When I was in Monsanto, we had a breeder training program that worked with a lot of the universities and brought them in and showed them what the program was like and what it was like breeding in an industry setting. We're currently working with you guys and with Margaret and the USDA and everyone on getting a FAR grant, right, to bring in some dollars to help fund some of these students and get them out there, either into academics or into industry. I think the key, though, is what was already brought up, was that finding ways to monetize those university programs, and so that there's an incentive for the companies to license material from those programs. That's a real demonstration of value that the universities seem to recognize today.
Yes?
Yeah, two comments. Probably in the future, you only see three or four universities that will train plant breeders, and that will be about it. I mean, it's just not going to, other universities are not going to do it because it's, they're going to be too, the programs will be too small to be viable. The second one, though, it has to do with the germplasm itself and the availability of germplasm, which is currently, in the gene banks. And of course, NAHA knows how great the funding is for gene banks and maintenance of germplasm. I mean, I guess I'm concerned because I was a gene bank curator a long time ago in ancient history. With the actual maintenance of material, we are losing plant germplasm, especially fruit germplasm. We're not accumulating anymore. You can't go and get it anymore for a number of reasons, including CBD. And if this becomes basically property within private companies, I think you basically have a situation where you're going to have, a quasi-monopoly situation.
Yeah, well, the comment was about the, with the privatization of breeding and less government funding and that sort of thing, that there may be fewer universities, just a handful that train breeders in the future, one of which will definitely be University of Arkansas. Then the other comment was about the importance of gene banks and the concern that, you know, with government funding being significantly reduced, gene banks being able to do less, and private companies having their own kind of private collections, how's that going to affect us? And I guess to make it less a question in addition to a comment, I'll ask you guys, how do you guys use gene banks in your own work, too? And do you have anything to follow up on that comment?
What?
Right. Yeah. Well. Yeah. We don't want our competitors to use our materials. You know, there's ways you can tie that up. You know, with utility patents and that sort of thing. Now PBPs and so forth. But I think the repositories, the USDA germplasm repositories, have been, at least for my use. We basically screened the entire table grape collection at both Geneva and Davis to look at the traits. But the problem is I only need to do that one time, you know, and then it sits there and it looks like nobody's using it, or, you know, the administrators say, well, nobody's been using this, so why do we keep it? But it is important, and you know, the one time you use it, it's really important.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, the germplasm banks have been really valuable to us. You know, the pink strawberry goes back to White Carolina, a 1700s variety we got from the repository, and we've drawn on them in other ways. And Jessica probably has all kinds of things to add about blueberries from the repository. But at least she's done a lot more of it than I have. But I was going to say, kind of what you were saying, I think the danger is not that private companies keep this and hoard it. The danger is that the private companies won't keep it, and we, as you know, if we lose the public resources, it just won't be there. Because I you know, I don't have the money to carry this kind of stuff mm-hmm. forever. I use what I need, and I make the crosses, and I get the hybrids, and then I just bet that if I need it again, I can go back to Corvallis and get it. So you know, I think. I wouldn't depend on private companies to become the stewards of our genetic diversity, because we're not set up to do it. Sorry if I put you on the spot.
No, I feel like I have to say something. So we have requested many different species from many different countries through the germplasm repository, so it has been hugely valuable for us, because to collect these plants, you have to go to the country, you have to find where they're growing, when they're fruiting, so you can get seed. So that's a lot of factors that have to come into play in order for you to successfully get that species into your program. And I don't think that we'd be able to have that kind of scope and diversity without the germplasm repository. Like Phil said, we don't have the money to keep everything and be the stewards of all the germplasm. I have a lot of things that they're finicky species. We treat them all the same, so frequently we have plants that die. And our crew is just not going to take the time to determine the perfect substrate, the perfect watering regime, the perfect nutrient regime for each of these different species, which they do at the repository, and that's really important and valuable. So I hope it doesn't go away, and I don't know if there's a way for industry to buy in and fund that, or what the real solution is.
Well, that would be my comment on that. Is, you know, you guys, if you're not going to keep it, and you're only going to use it once or twice until you need it again a long time from now, you know, somebody's going to have to do it, and there's no advocate for the germplasm out there unless you guys advocate strongly to the people and congressmen. You know, at the regional, for the W6, for example, we talk about this all the time. And, you know, and usually the idea is that growers are going to advocate. And growers aren't necessarily the greatest advocates. I mean, they just look at, you know, how much money they're making every year a lot of times. I mean, a couple of crops I know about. And so the question is, I mean, who's going to advocate for it? Because the USDA internally does not. I mean, USDA administrators basically are told that they are not to be advocates for their program, that they are managers for the program, and if you advocate strongly for the program, you're going to be in some trouble. So somebody from outside, I don't know where that's going to come from.
just to summarize the comment before we move on, it was that, you know, advocacy is really important for maintaining the viability of the gene banks over the course of time, and these private companies that are benefiting from the use of the gene banks would be excellent advocates, so we should organize a trip to Capitol Hill. Ryan, before we move on to you, John, Ryan, do you have any comment about maybe what y'all are doing with the gene bank?
Yeah, I would just go say really quickly, so number one, the gene bank was hugely important to my own PhD, so I worked on out of the college, the Cotton sessions out of College Station. I also worked out of the Echinacea sessions out of the Iowa State location. I put stuff into it as well. And we are currently doing a project with Margaret and with Courtney and a bunch of other people where we're currently propagating 500, you know, accessions and species out of the Corvallis collection for rubus. And so it is an incredibly important resource. There are examples where companies have worked with it. So Monsanto, much maligned, it often did some good things. So for 10 years, it used a huge portion, not a huge portion, but a sizable number of molecular markers it ran for the maize repository to help them deal with all the purity and crossing issues and making sure that the stocks were being kept the right way. And so I think that there are vehicles where companies can participate, and I think it's up to us, the people at the USDA, the responsible parties that work with them at the universities and the industry, to actually figure out how we want to do it and go to Capitol Hill.
John, I think you have something to add.
One of the things I was interested in with the original idea of the session, had in mind if I was a graduate student or about to be a young professional in plant breeding, fruit breeding, berry breeding, how I would view career opportunities. And a factor, at least when I came along a long time ago, it was job security and tenure appeared to be, plus stable income, and I wouldn't be milking cows back in Mississippi, there were major things that thought made me think that university job is good. So I'm very curious, and we have quite an array of career paths here, and yours in it. What do you think about the so-called job security of a university with tenure, which in theory could be a career opportunity, versus an industry, which tomorrow they could say, we don't need you anymore, buddy?
Well, once you get tenure, that's a great thing. It's pretty hard to get rid of you, I think. But I've been in all three USDA, university, and private, and I've gone through two bankruptcies. So, yeah, there's no job security in private sector. You know, you're here today and gone tomorrow if you don't make money for the company or the objectives change and that sort of thing. So, but on the other hand, my situation is for a long time I was a one-man show, so I got to set everything, do what I wanted to do, and so that's worked out well for me. I really enjoyed the last job here in my career, so it's been fun.
I mean, I definitely wouldn't turn down tenure if someone offered it to me at Driscoll's. I mean, one factor is there just aren't that many tenure-track jobs out there. So, you know, if you're hell-bent on having one, you may be looking for a long time. Private sector is not monolithic either. I mean, I think, you know, you go work for a tiny startup, I think, you know, the level of job security there is different than the level of job security at a well-established company like Driscoll's. I don't have any illusions that, you know, my job is guaranteed forever, but I'd like to think it would be painful and complicated to get rid of me at this point. or at least painful. I guess it wouldn't have to be complicated. But, you know, I think there are upsides, too. You know, somebody was saying, you know, you watch your advisor in grad school, you know, struggle to find grants to make things happen, and, you know, scrounge for money to plant seedlings and things like that. That, you know, I came into Driscoll's and I basically walked into several $1 million in research funds, which poses other issues, but is a good problem to have. And I think it's one of the things that really has been nice about Driscoll's is that, you know, we have a lot of resources and we have an ability to make an impact in a big way relatively quickly. You know, I came in and, you know, released a bunch of varieties and, you know, a couple years later people were making millions of dollars off them. I wasn't making millions of dollars off them, but somebody was. And it's kind of satisfying to see an impact, you know, a big impact fast like that.
So I came from the University of Florida, where the breeding programs had a really nice royalty stream funneling back into the labs and the breeders. So when I was looking for jobs, I wasn't looking exclusively at industry positions, but there really wasn't a lot available at the time. So the only open position that I applied to was the only open breeder position that I applied to was the Driscoll's position. The Arkansas position, when John emailed me, the application was open. I had already moved to California and accepted the job. So it was not like a matter of choosing between the two for me. It was what was available at the time, and there really just wasn't anything. Breeders, I think, they get into their role and they hold on to that for a very long time for pretty obvious reasons. You want to make gains in your germplasm and you get attached to your plants. It's not one of those easy roles that you can move from company to company every 3 years. Being tenured and having royalties on those cultivars that I developed, yeah, that would be amazing. But also not having the right grants, and the parking lot at Driscoll's clears out about 5 o'clock p.m., which is also something I value. So, yeah.
Any comment on that?
Yeah. So maybe a little different perspective. Industry right now, and especially, I mean, on the row crop side for sure, and I'm pretty sure over here because we're looking for people, there are not enough people trained in agriculture that are being produced to fill the roles that are there. And so what has happened is the industry very much values the people that it has. So even if the companies change their focus and roles need to go away, every company that I've worked at has endeavored to keep those people as long as they are willing to work on the problems that need to be worked on. And that's been my general experience in the last 12 years. The other piece is just that, you know, the faculty positions are really almost a unicorn out there in the job market, right? In terms of the number of them and the fact that you do have tenure, nowhere else in the job market does that system really exist, right? And so you're basically working through the same game that most people are working through as they go through their careers, and that's not such a scary thing.
Huh, those are great answers. You know, I know we had another question in the back, but I'm going to jump in just while we're on the grad student topic in case we have any grad students, undergrads here who are interested. Is there anything that kind of surprised you when you got started working in the private sector that you thought, wow, I wish I had done this or learned this when I was in grad school? So recommendations that you have to the students out there about what they can do to make themselves more competitive for industry jobs and more successful when they get there?
A couple of things. So one, if you have the opportunity to do an internship with a company, do it. Learn what it really means to collaborate. Working in a large academic lab sometimes gives you a flavor of that, but really collaborating like you have to do at companies isn't a skill set that you get found until you get there. And the other piece is that if you can learn a little bit of something about project management and how to work with those sorts of tools as you do your work, that's also will be a huge leg up for you making that transition.
Yeah, I was really surprised by going from my PhD, where I had one project, I was responsible for all aspects of it being completed, to getting a position where I suddenly had, you know, 5 of these projects of equal scale. I had help doing them, but yeah, it was much more of the project management side of it, designing the experiments, and then making sure all of it happened actually. So, and the people that you're handing these pieces off to, they have multiple things, so it's not like their sole responsibility. So that kind of interpersonal relationship skills are hugely important. So if you have the opportunity to somehow get that experience in grad school, that's really valuable. Something I still don't really do in my job is any sort of budgeting. Thankfully, Jim, I fall under his umbrella, and he just gives me money. but that was something that I didn't really see in grad school, and if I had to do it now, it would definitely be a learning curve for me.
Yeah, I would echo those comments that no matter where you end up, you're going to end up managing people somehow, whether it's your technician or field labor or whatever. So that's something you don't get. In my case, I was the general manager of the company, and I had no idea how to even read a balance sheet. Still don't know very much about it. So business, managing a business is a lot different than working in a laboratory. The other aspect I'd say is, I don't know how it is with Driscoll, but you have to know not just the genetics, but you have to know, first of all, how to grow the plant, because it doesn't do you much good unless you have you got to get the seedlings to germinate and keep them alive until you get them to the field and fruiting. So, yeah, there's a broad array of skills you need to make be successful, I think.
Yeah, I would basically echo what everybody else has said at this point. I would just kind of expand on that a little bit. I think from my perspective, one thing that if you're talking about what it would be good to see on, you know, grad students who are applying for jobs, there's a lot of people in plant breeding right now who don't have a lot of experience with actual farming and actual plants. You can learn stuff on the job, and it's not, you know, smart, motivated people can do all kinds of things. But I really, you know, when I'm looking at applicants, it's nice to see somebody who's actually worked with growers, you know, worked on a farm, worked with actual plants. And you know, I think as you know, the academic breeding programs move away from, you know, the hands-on traditional plant breeding kind of things and more into the molecular realm and things like that, there is a danger that, you know, the people who come out to be our plant breeders haven't really done that much with plants. So it's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, those are excellent comments and something to keep in mind when you're thinking about where to study and looking at different labs you might work in for your graduate degree. And I'll say to everybody, if you are interested in the public sector, all these things will help you get a faculty job too, plus publish. So we have a question in the back. For those who couldn't hear and those listening later, the comment was that maybe new faculty jobs will open up soon when people eventually retire. Everybody just loves their jobs too much. And then also about the importance of germplasm repositories, that there can always be new diseases and new issues that pop up that you're not aware of when you go through and do the initial screen, so it is very important to maintain them in perpetuity. We have time for one more question. Who has a burning question?
I have a question.
Okay.
So let's say hypothetically a physician is opening rootstock breeding or something. What would you? What would the panel recommend to a search committee chairs? How should they form this or frame this job description, so on and so forth, in the public sector?
Okay, the question was, if there's a new public sector job that comes open, the person that's going to train your new hires and that sort of thing, and it's a rootstock position, I guess, theoretically, how would you form that job description.
You're the only one who uses rootstock.
You don't graft blueberries? I tell you. No, I don't quite know how to answer the question. I think you have to have once you get that PhD, that's just kind of the beginning. There's a lot you still have to learn, and you learn on the job. I think looking for somebody who has that sort of broad background, the enthusiasm, and for the job. I don't know what else to say.
I mean, I think you want somebody who's going to be engaged with the industry. Speaking from the industry perspective, one thing with tenure is that once you've hired them and they're there, that you've sort of lost some of your ability to shape where they go. And so if you have somebody who's interested and engaged with what industry needs, that person is more likely to stay in tune with what the industry needs and do relevant research.
Right?
Did you have anything? Or?
You can go for it.
So I think regardless of what the people are working on, when we're hiring, we're always looking for people that know how to think. I'm routinely floored by the number of people that get through a PhD without having to have thought through all the steps because their advisor thought through it all for them. So if you can hire someone that is really going to teach people how to think on their own, develop their thought processes, the material knowledge about rootstock or about whatever it is, that's table stakes, right? The thing that is always discerning to us when we're selecting the best candidate from there is, can this person actually think and can they drive something forward? So.
Okay, well, I think we've about run out of time for this, and I don't want us to get into the viticulture and small fruit business meeting time, but I want to thank all of our panelists. I thought this was a really interesting discussion, so great job, everyone. Thanks so much for participating.